in which goodwill has a value and wealth has a time limit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, 8 August today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A very brief moment as we get going for this. Did you hear that? Nothing. No big trade war news today. Nothing about the currency war. No market craziness. Take your moments where you can get them, right? Take them, we will. In non-crisis economic news, the corporate story of this Thursday is brought to us by Velveeta and Cool Whip. Today was not a good day for parent company Kraft Heinz. The company reported its 12th straight quarter, that is 3 years' worth of lousy sales. It also said that those aforementioned brands and some others that the company owns just aren't worth as much as they used to be. Specifically, the company said it had lost $474 million worth of something called goodwill. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore helps us understand.
Goodwill, a warm and fuzzy feeling, like on Sesame Street.
I like you.
Well, on Wall Street, there's something kind of like that, just minus the warm feelings part.
Goodwill is one type of intangible asset that a company might have.
Michelle Hanlon's professor of accounting at MIT Sloan School. When one company buys another, it'll pay money for, you know, the stuff that the company owns.
The equipment, the buildings, you know, the trademarks.
But then usually you pay extra because you like this company. You see something in it. It has a certain je ne sais quoi.
There's some value above and beyond the value of those identifiable assets.
Like maybe that company is strategically valuable to you, or you'll become more efficient by getting it, or there's also mushier stuff.
You know, if you have very loyal customers, you know, Apple has very loyal customers, but that's not something that Apple would have on their balance sheet.
The extra money above the paper value that one company pays to buy another, that money is listed as goodwill.
This is one of the most subjective and judgmental areas of accounting.
Doug Skinner is professor of accounting at Chicago's Booth School. Kraft Heinz, for example, had to estimate the je ne sais quoi value of all the companies it's bought over the years. Like, what's their market price now? And, well, they're not looking so good.
Clean living. People just are looking for a healthier lifestyle. They don't want as much processed food.
Pete Bible is chief risk officer with Eisner Amper. He says some of Kraft Heinz's magic is gone. And on Wall Street, even magic has a price tag. It's called goodwill. Hundreds of millions of dollars worth of it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
To consumer retail we turn now. Fashion in general. Clothing rental in particular. Bloomingdale's is launching something similar to Rent the Runway, which has been leasing designer dresses and accessories for almost a decade now. There's also talk today that Hudson's Bay, which owns Lord & Taylor, is going to be partnering with the clothing rental service Le Tote. And this summer, Nordstrom announced it's partnering with Rent the Runway itself. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains the department store rental connection.
Department stores have a lot of problems these days. Among them, they can't seem to attract younger customers. Robert Conrad teaches fashion merchandising at LIM College.
We survey millennials and now Gen Z and talk about shopping habits and buying patterns. And invariably, department stores fall to the bottom of the list of places to go.
Instead, a lot of millennials are shopping online and renting clothes from companies like Rent the Runway, Le Tote, and the Miz Collection. Veronica Sansev is the co-founder of the marketing conference Commerce Next.
For millennial consumers, what you're seeing a lot of times is they're buying the basics. So their jeans, they're like solid colors. But all of those pieces that are more expressive and unique and fashion pieces, those are starting to move into the rental market.
So department stores see an opportunity to reach these customers and collect data on what they search for, what they rent, which outfits they keep. But starting a clothing rental service, even for an established retailer like Bloomingdale's, won't be easy. It'll need to dry clean, inspect, and track every piece of clothing. Sansev says Rent the Runway has that down to a science.
You know, they are getting in clothes at 10 o'clock in the morning. They are cleaning it, mending it, and getting it back out into the market by something like 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And that takes a huge logistical operation.
Which is why some department stores are partnering with existing rental companies. In return, the rental companies get access to racks full of clothes and a whole lot of fitting rooms for their customers. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You know what Wall Street did with the absence of trade war and currency war news? Yeah, it went up is what it did, a lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I was talking to Brian Duncan, our hog farmer out in Illinois, the other day about agriculture and the trade war. Circular bad news is what he called it, the repetitive cycle of tariffs and counter-tariffs, threats and more threats. Ag relies a whole lot on exports is the thing. But even before this administration took over, some parts of the American farming industry had been having some problems. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
There's a 400-cow farm in Wisconsin called the Nelson Family Dairy Farm. Sarah Lloyd runs it with her husband, and she says dairy farms across the country are facing a big issue.
We really do have too much milk on the market.
And that's pushed prices so low that hundreds of farms in Wisconsin are going out of business. Lloyd says for her farm, it's been a struggle.
The Nelson family farm has been in business for over 100 years. We're really just digging deep into the asset base that the generations have built.
Until around 2014, dairy prices had been high, and dairy farmers had been expanding their operations, says Naomi Bloom at the advisory firm Stewart Peterson.
It was kind of this domino effect where each dairy farm, in their own way, was trying to become bigger.
Then global milk prices plummeted. China drastically cut back on its milk imports. The EU lifted production quotas. Russia banned Western dairy imports. But farms had to keep producing milk, even if they were getting less for it, to make their loan payments. The dairy industry has had help. Federal subsidies have been estimated to make up as much as 73% of dairy farm income. And Dan Sumner, an ag economist at UC Davis, says farms should be designed to withstand price swings.
Farm prices go up and down. That's part of the business.
Sumner says what's unusual this time is how long they've been down. And it's not just dairy. Prices for a lot of ag commodities have been down for several years. By now, he says they should have recovered.
That hasn't really happened for a lot of commodities, in part because they're so sensitive to the international trade turmoil.
China is the fifth largest export market for American agriculture, including soybeans, corn, hogs. Before the trade dispute, it had been a top export market for years. With that market closed, supply is building up in the U.S. California and Wisconsin, the two biggest milk producers, are receiving $130 billion in aid this year to cope with the trade war. Sumner says there's another reason prices are staying low. The industry is getting more productive. It's getting better at farming.
That means that those people can produce the crops and the livestock products at slightly lower prices.
Dairy prices are starting to rise a bit. Dean Foods, the biggest milk producer in the U.S., said this week that it's paying more for milk. Part of that is a result of all the rain we've had this year. That made it hard to plant feed crops, so prices are up. Then there's lower production, dairy farms going out of business. But back at the Nelson family dairy farm, Sarah Lloyd says reduced milk production could help farmers in the long run.
We just really need to talk with people about, hey, what if you produce less and got paid more?
The National Farmers Union has called for a government incentive program to better control the dairy market. That could mean capping production or charging a fee if farmers want to expand. So far, nothing's made it through Congress. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The wealth gap in this economy has been higher profile than usual lately. It's come up in the presidential race. Jay Powell is talking about it at the Fed. Of course, closing the difference between the rich and the poor in this society is obviously easier said than done, and it gets even more difficult when you add race into that mix. Maura Cheeks wrote about her own family's past in The Atlantic not too long ago. It's a story called American Wealth is Broken. Maura, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I want to start up at the top of this long, it's a long piece, but right near the top, you talk about black wealth as being delicate, and I want you to explain what that means.
Well, I was really interested in writing about intergenerational wealth. I think a lot of the conversation about wealth focuses on closing the wealth gap, but we don't really talk about the implications of intergenerational wealth. And what does that mean if your parents have money or your grandparents have money? And what kind of opportunities does that afford you? And so that's what I mean when I say Black wealth is delicate, because for a lot of families, the intergenerational safety net isn't there.
So I can't decide here, actually, whether I want to go to your dad, Maurice Cheeks, basketball player, now a basketball coach in the NBA for many, many years, or your grandfather. And I think really what we have to do is go to your granddad, right?
Well, my grandfather started an HVAC company in Philadelphia. He started his company by selling air conditioners on the side while he was still employed with a full-time job. And eventually his side hustle, as I call it in the piece, afforded him the opportunity to be able to go out on his own. That was really the basis for my family safety net, was that, you know, him being the first generation of becoming an entrepreneur and really building that business and, you know, moving us into right. a nice neighborhood and a nice house. And I was given the opportunity to go to a fantastic school.
Right. Except the house then, it doesn't end well, right?
In that particular instance, it did not end well. And yeah. for me, it was very illuminating to be one of few Black students in the school. And then suddenly I'm going through the process of us having to sell our home.
Right.
And so having to sell that really opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, we didn't really have a substantial safety net. And the reason for that partly is because of the policies that have affected African-Americans right. for generations.
So let's talk about some of those, right? And why was it that your grandfather has a business deal go bad, which is what happened, and you lose the family house? Structurally, what has happened in this economy to make, as you say, African-American wealth so fragile, so tenuous?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I write a lot about data from the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, which is the world's longest running longitudinal household survey. And a lot of researchers have analyzed this data. You know, they found that the family circumstances of Black middle-income Americans results in Black families having 27% less wealth than their white counterparts. If you look at these numbers, it's pretty apparent that the wealth gap isn't an accident because of the lack of intergenerational wealth in Black families.
So let's get now to your dad. Maurice Cheeks, as I said, played in the NBA, made decent money for his time, but not exceptional money, right? And you write that the first thing he did when he started getting pro basketball paychecks was literally to send money home.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it seem, you know, like we're victims and we're not fortunate for where we've come from. I mean, he has done amazing. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame. He is successful. In a lot of cases, we look at these success stories and we think, well, they've made it. And that isn't the case. I mean, his mom, my grandmother, was still living in the Robert Taylor homes in the yeah. housing projects.
Yeah.
And so that factors into wealth as well.
Do you feel fragile?
I do not, but that is a result of my family.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at white counterparts in my same position, they would feel a lot more stability than I feel. And I think that that is a result of the fact that my family, like many, many African American families, are still, you know, grappling with the realities of the policies and, to be frank, the legacy of slavery.
Mm, for sure.
Black people for a very long time were considered the wealth of this country. And so until we acknowledge that, I think there are still going to be issues with the way we talk about closing the wealth gap in a meaningful way.
More Cheeks, writing not too long ago in The Atlantic about Black wealth and her family and how that all plays out. Maura, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
And so finally, one day, I trapped her in the hallway.
Man, high school counselors can be tough, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Oh, that's interesting. I don't know if I'd have done that. But okay, the happy music, the very happy music. Dow Industrial is up 371 today, 1.4% in the absence of trade war news. 26,378 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ increased 176 points, nearly 2.25% there. 8,039. The S&P 500 found 54 points, 1.8%, 29.38. It's entirely subjective, by the way, that music thing. Kraft Heinz, we mentioned, down 8.5% today. Not everything came unwrapped in the packaged food business, though. Mondelez International rose 2.8% today. General Mills crunched up 2%. Zillow revealed in its quarterly earnings report that its new home flipping business maybe ain't. Zillow slumped more than 15.5% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up just a touch, 1.72%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Two words, people, two words, free shipping. A report from the National Retail Federation says 75% of us don't expect to have to pay to get stuff delivered to our front door. That might get more of us to click the checkout button, sure, but more online shopping also means more returns. And for companies, the sales loss, the shipping costs, the warehouse space, the restocking, it all adds up. So Lila Goldstein set out to discover exactly how retailers are dealing with that deluge of returns.
Nina Frank Williams loves the experience of sifting through secondhand clothes at Goodwill. But when it comes to finding jeans with that perfect fit, she turns to the internet.
I really like Levi's jeans, and they have a lot more selection online as far as the styles go.
She recently ordered three different pairs of Levi's. Two weren't right, so she sent them back. And she was curious, what happened to those jeans after she returned them?
Where does it end up? Does it get resold? Does it get trashed? You know, what's the life of this returned merchandise?
Williams' guesses are on the right track. Some returns might be put back on store shelves. Others end up in a landfill. Some are sold in bulk, and some are donated. None of that is unusual. What's new is the amount of returns retailers are dealing with because of online shopping. E-commerce sales in the U.S. topped $500 billion in 2018, up almost 15% from the year before.
Return rates on online sales are much higher than return rates from brick-and-mortar sales. 3, 4, 5 times higher.
Jordan Jakubowicz is with Optoro, a company that makes software to streamline the returns process. Optoro's clients include big retailers like Target and Best Buy. He says the kind of automation that makes shipping orders out so efficient these days, i.e. robots, isn't exactly possible when return items come back to the retailers.
Returns don't come back neatly packaged in pristine boxes. You might get a truck at the warehouse that has a laptop on it, and it has a lawnmower, and it has a t-shirt, and it has a bouncy ball.
So retailers use data analytics to reduce costs when sorting out returns, spending more resources on $2,000 TVs, say, and less on $2 socks. Companies also bundle up returned merchandise and auction it off to resellers on sites like liquidation.com.
This stuff, all of this equipment, everything you see, is what we bought on liquidation pallets.
Here in his living room in Queens, New York, Naveed Ahmed sorts through a recent shipment. The furniture is covered with boxes of Amazon and Walmart returns. Wooden pallets stacked 4 feet high with merchandise get delivered to his curb. Each one costs around $400 to $800. He does get to see a list of what's included before he bids, but the condition of the items is no guarantee. Take this brand new Milwaukee drill bit set. He says the original buyer,
they took out one piece that they needed, and they shipped all of this back.
Stacks of DVDs, four mini towers, and a set of Ralph Lauren crystal drinking glasses rests on the couch.
I'm not sure about how to resell something that expensive and why somebody would want to buy it.
Once he inspects everything, he'll donate the low-quality stuff and trash the broken things. He pays for electronic waste to be taken away and also spends $900 a month on a storage unit. The good stuff, he reboxes and resells on sites like, you guessed it, Amazon.
We can make somewhere between $150 to $250 per pallet.
But there's always the possibility that the things Ahmed sells will also get returned. And that's a huge headache for him.
Being a seller, I understand how painful it can be and how it can make or break businesses.
That's changed the way he shops for himself. Even though Amazon returns fuel his business, he says in the last year, he hasn't returned a thing. I'm Lila Goldstein for Marketplace.
All right, there's been a lot of company news today, so stay with me here. I'm going to get a little bit Seinfeldian on you here. Have you ever noticed how we add possessive S's to company names all the time, even when they don't have an S on the end? Is it Tiffany or Tiffany's? Sizzler or Sizzler's? Nordstrom or Nordstrom's?
Nordstrom's.
I think it's Nordstrom.
Nordstrom's.
I think it's Nordstrom.
That was Juan Alejandro Ford, Annabelle Seymour, Oscar Villaseñor, and Michael DeGeorge. We got them all here in downtown Los Angeles. We've got a whole story about why we do that S thing at marketplace.org. Colleges and universities across the country are about to get going with the new academic year if they haven't already. A good chunk of those students, past and present, probably got some help from their high school counselor. The starting point for today's installment of our series, My Economy. This one comes from a high school right outside Chicago.
My name is Aliza Gilbert. I am a college counselor at Highland Park High School in Highland Park, Illinois. I was a first-generation college student, a low-income first-generation college student. I knew that I was always going to go to college. I just didn't necessarily know kind of how to get there, how to get from point A to point B. But many of my friends had parents who had gone to college, and they were doing things like taking the SAT and taking the ACT. And so I just went along and registered because they did. It is that lens and that experience that guides me in the work that I do. I had a student who was in the top 10% of her class, and she never applied to college. And I would tell her to come and meet with me, and she would kind of dodge me. And so finally, one day, I trapped her in the hallway. And I brought her into my office and I sat her down and I said, so you have not applied to college. Like, tell me what you're thinking. And she just immediately burst into tears. At that moment, I realized that she was not documented. She had an older sister who I did not know, who had applied to college and, because of her undocumented status, was charged out-of-state tuition. She just knew that her parents could not afford that, and so she could not go to college. But by the time this young woman was in high school, Illinois was one of the number of states that had passed tuition equity legislation, which is where undocumented students who have attended a high school for 3 years have an opportunity to pay in-state tuition at a state university. And I said, well, this is what you would have to pay to go to college. And she looked at me in disbelief, and she said, we can do that. She said, "We can definitely do that." But what I remember most about this was that lots of students who think that college isn't an option give up on high school, right? Because there's no reason for high school if it's not to help you go to college. And I said, well, you didn't think that. Why did you work so hard in high school? And what made you want to be so successful? And she said, I decided that if this was the only education that I was ever going to get, that I better not waste it.
Aliza Gilbert, helping kids navigate college from Highland Park High School outside of Chicago. You know, we can only do this series with your help. Share your story with us about your economy at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, serendipity, thy name is Lil Nas X. This item from Bloomberg. You've heard about Old Town Road, right? The 18 weeks at the top of the Billboard 100 country rap hit song, whose lyrics include this line, "Wrangler on my booty." Says Wrangler's parent company CEO Scott Baxter, "We knew nothing about it." And then it just took off from there. Of course, Wrangler put together a co-branding thing with Lil Nas X, quoting Baxter again, "Every time we put more product online, it sold out immediately." Because, you know, Wrangler on my booty. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 371 today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 176 points, nearly 2.25% there. The S&P 554 points to the good, 1.8%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Aaron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.